And good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, just about 10 o'clock, actually 9 o'clock here on this Thursday morning. In about a half hour, join us for Fight the Empire. Today, host Per Fogering speaks with Michael Dybert about his new book, In the Shadow of Saint Death, The Gulf Cartel and the Price of America's Drug War in Mexico. At 10, it's Chris Andre hosting Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, the U.S. pushes successfully for the remilitarization of Japan. Native Americans roughed up and detained at AT&T Park in San Francisco get an apology and a pair of tickets, but they want what they want much more. And a report from the Gaza Strip on the deadly impact of continuing Israeli bombing there. At 11 on Between the Covers, host Lynn Molick speaks with author and editor Todd Davies about her latest book, In the Jam Today, in the Jam Today series. Jam Today 2, The Revolution Will Not Be Catered. At 11:30 on Black Book Talk, the guest is Rashonda Tate Billingsley, author of 30 books, including Let the Church Say Amen, which has been made into a movie. But first, it's Press Watch up next with host Teresa Mitchell looking at anarcho-socialism versus climate change and the news you're not supposed to know. Stay with us.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Sex Workers film series, which on Saturday, July 5th at 7 p.m. will show The Price of Sex. This feature-length documentary sheds light on the underground criminal network of human trafficking and the experiences of trafficked Eastern European women forced into prostitution abroad. The Price of Sex includes first-person accounts, as well as interviews with traffickers, clients, and anti-trafficking activists to expose the root causes, complex connections, and stark significance of sexual slavery today. Again, that's Saturday, July 5th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion show here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know, giving you the tools to destroy billionaire rule. Hurricane Arthur is heading for the U.S. East Coast. While middle-aged conservative whites in California are bravely confronting starving children, what's the first thing that comes to your mind when you hear that busloads of starving kids are coming your way? Do you grab some pillows, some cheese sticks? No, you grab the American flag and say, send them back. So, if you're looking at the news today, it's best to keep a bucket by your side. Now, if the U.S. were more of an anarcho-socialist society than a victim of capitalism, how would we address climate change? I ask because under capitalism, we don't address climate change. We just worry about it while our billionaire ruling class finds ways to ensure that we can do nothing collectively. But if democracy were to break out in the U.S., well, if democracy were to break out in the U.S., of course, the first thing we'd have to deal with is the cops, I'm sure. But there's a lot we could do. Once we got to the other side of that, we could ban daily car commuting and make cars just for play. And first, that would involve redistributing land according to workers' rights. Your job would move to you, where possible. And dormitories and pied-à-terre housing could be provided next to the workplace. Since we wouldn't be in the business of enriching elites anymore, we could decentralize power production, saving tremendously by cutting out power transmission line loss and distributing solar panels. We could ban contrail-forming flights at night, which hold in the heat on the planet. We could increase our gross domestic happiness. Under capitalism, growing the economy is doublespeak for increasing the power of the super rich. But we could instead grow happiness, grow gardens, grow comfort, joy, transcendence, justice. And if we needed to kill something, we could kill Jim Crow, not Iraqis. Just an idea. A little anarcho-socialism there. Wanted to throw that out there. Lots of news rolling around. Chris Marsden has written in WSWS.org, that's World Socialist, and also it's been reprinted in globalresearch.ca. Ukrainian forces have launched a series of bloody attacks in the eastern regions following the declared end Monday of a 10-day ceasefire. The nominal ceasefire was never truly operational. Heavy fighting and artillery bombardments, he writes, were reported around the rebel-controlled cities of Slovyansk and Kramatorsk beginning at 19:30 hours Monday. Grad rockets were also fired at the city of Karlovka. Those are those Stalin organ rockets. Igor Stelkov, the Russian commander of rebels in Slovyansk, said that many civilians had been wounded when government forces shelled several villages around the city. At least four people were killed and five more wounded after a passenger bus came under fire in Ukraine's Donetsk region Tuesday morning. Russia protested the death Monday night of a Russian journalist, Anatoly Klyan, a cameraman for state-owned Channel 1, who was shot in the stomach by Ukrainian forces on a bus carrying journalists and soldiers' mothers. And the footage for that, by the way, is pretty gripping. You can find that on YouTube. Returning to Marsden's article yesterday, meaning earlier this week, Ukraine's parliament speaker declared the active phase of the counterterrorism operation resumed in the morning. Our armed forces are striking the bases and strongholds of the terrorists. And departing from this, once again, there's news this morning that Poroshenko is sacking some of the leaders of the armed forces in Ukraine. They are led by the Nazi party now, the right sector and the Svoboda Nazis. So I'm not sure that that means a change in ideological leadership, but a couple of people are being removed anyway. He's not happy with the way they've been shooting people up. Not that they haven't been bloody enough, but just not making the progress that he would like. Returning to the article, Parliament was prepared to consider a request by Poroshenko for the imposition of a state of emergency in the east after he declared in a televised address that Ukrainian forces would attack and liberate our land. Termination of ceasefire is our response to terrorists, insurgents, and marauders. And he said the armed forces, the National Guard, the State Border Service, and the Security Service received appropriate orders. Poroshenko blamed the pro-Russian rebels in the Donetsk and Luhansk regions for failing to honor the ceasefire and denounced the government of Vladimir Putin in Moscow for allegedly failing to rein them in. He said, militants had failed to take up a unique opportunity to support his peace plan, Poroshenko said, and had violated the ceasefire more than 100 times. Later, in chilling fascistic language on his Facebook page, Poroshenko declared that, quote, "We must be united because we are fighting to free our land from dirt and parasites," end quote. So there's more on that article, a lot more. You can find that at either globalresearch.ca or WSWS.org. Now, if you're listening to KBOO Portland, earlier this week, you know that climate justice activists with Portland Rising Tide shut down the ARC Logistics crude oil terminal in northwest Portland. And I'm reading from Earth First Newswire from earlier this week. Train cars enter from a nearby yard to offload oil into 84 storage tanks before it is piped into ocean-going ships bound for West Coast refineries. And Portland resident Irene Madgery, 22, locked herself to a 55-gallon barrel filled with concrete that was placed on the railroad track leading into the facility. Her arm was locked to a piece of metal rebar embedded into the concrete, and she effectively stopped trains for 4 hours before being cut out by police. Attempts by law enforcement to move her and the barrel simultaneously risked grave injury. Likewise, any train traffic threatened her life. Madgery said this is about stopping the oil trains, but beyond that, it is about an industry and an economic system that places the pursuit of profit before the lives and relationships of human beings seeking survival and nourishment, and before the communities, ecosystems, and planet of which we are a part, end quote. And Earth First writes, oil trains are coming under increasing scrutiny recently owing to their propensity to derail in fiery explosions. Portland Rising Tide, however, disputes the notion that an oil train is ever safe. Since crude oil is only transported to be burned, whatever the risk of explosion, the guaranteed result is worsening of the climate crisis, which is already wreaking ecological havoc and claiming human lives. More on that at Earth First. And my own comments, in the course of my blue-collar work, I pass by rail yard off Greeley Avenue, and I do see often those oil trains stretching as far as the eye can see. And if you've ever watched a rail yard, you know that usually when the trains are put together, those coupling latches work pretty well. And now and then they roll those trains together pretty hard. And now and then, every once in a while, they really ram them into each other. And when you think about that and watch that going on, well, just remember that back and oil can go off like a bomb, like a really big, smoky, poisonous, radioactive bomb. This from Reuters. West African states lack the resources to battle the world's worst outbreak of Ebola. And deep cultural suspicions about the disease remain a big obstacle to halting its spread. That's according to state ministers talking yesterday. In Africa, the outbreak has killed 467 people in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone since February, making it the largest and deadliest ever, according to the World Health Organization. West African health ministers meeting in Ghana to draw up a regional response mixed appeals for cash with warnings of the practices that have allowed the disease to spread across borders and into cities. The deputy health minister for Sierra Leone, a country with one of the world's weakest health systems, said cash was needed for drugs, basic protective gear, and staff pay. And departing from this article, having looked at other articles and articles coming directly out of Africa, cash is needed is an understatement. Really, they just, I mean, they can scarcely get enough bleach to keep things clean, and not to mention enough money for moon suits and personnel. This is a situation in which the world would greatly benefit by getting a lot of cash right away and a lot of logistical help to Sierra Leone and affected areas. I return to the article. Sierra Leone announced on Wednesday that the president, his vice president, and all cabinet ministers would donate half of their salaries to help fight the outbreak, though the total amount of the donations was not disclosed. Quoting, in Liberia, our biggest challenge is denial, fear, and panic. Our people are very much afraid of the disease, end quote. And that's from Bernice Dawn, Liberia's deputy health minister, telling Reuters on the sidelines of the meeting in Accra about the deadly and incurable disease. From Chikako Kawahara, writing in Asahi Shimbun, concentrations of radioactive cesium on the seafloor after the 2011 Fukushima nuclear disaster were discovered to be higher in muddy depressions than on the rocky seabed. That's according to maritime researchers, quoting Blair Thornton, researcher for University of Tokyo Institute of Industrial Science. She said, we are learning that the nuclear accident didn't contaminate the entire ocean, but created spots that tend to have higher radioactive levels than others. We want to continue investigating, end quote. At the request of the Nuclear Regulation Authority, a team of researchers from University of Tokyo, the National Maritime Research Institute, and Kanazawa University charted a distance of more than 1,000 kilometers. Sites measured ran 50 kilometers north to south and 25 kilometers west to east, off the coast of Fukushima Prefecture, where the stricken Fukushima No. 1 nuclear power plant is located. Now, I just want to talk about some of the language in this. The quote saying that the ocean was not contaminated is simply incorrect. And when you hear stricken Fukushima nuclear power plant, you might think that, well, it's got a problem. Maybe they'll put it back together someday. It's not stricken. It's absolutely rubble. But returning to the article, they used a ship equipped with an instrument specially developed to measure seafloor gamma ray levels while simultaneously surveying the underwater, underwater landscape using sonar. And they found much higher concentrations in depressions in the area. However, you can clap along with Happy Fukushima. And this is from the Japan News. And it shows an image with a woman dancing near the Koriyama Station near Fukushima. A YouTube video showing people in disaster-hit Fukushima Prefecture dancing joyously to American singer Pharrell Williams' hit song Happy has been extremely popular, having been played on the internet 439,000 times. The video is the first in a set of three similar videos that were recently filmed in Iwate. Williams' song, which repeats the phrase, "Because I'm happy with a light rhythm," was released late last year. Since then, people created their own videos with the song as a soundtrack. And Hitomi Kumasaka, a 53-year-old consulting firm manager in Fukushima, came up with the idea of creating a Fukushima version after learning on the internet of a widespread misunderstanding that people can no longer live in Fukushima Prefecture due to the nuclear accident caused by the earthquake and tsunami. Some things you just can't make up. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. From Russia Today, let's get a little Russian propaganda for a change. Facebook's experiment on over 500,000 unsuspecting users has taken a new twist with the revelation that a researcher connected to a Department of Defense-funded program to use the military to quell civil unrest also participated in the study. Social media sites exploded over the weekend after it was revealed that Facebook, no stranger to controversy of late, secretly manipulated posts being seen by nearly 700,000 users in 2012 to allow researchers to study how emotional states are transmitted over the platform. Results of the week-long study conducted by researchers at Facebook, Cornell University, and the University of California appeared in the June edition of the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Scientists. Under the rather insidious title, Experimental Evidence of Massive-Scale Emotional Contagion Through Social Networks. Facebook altered the content that showed up on certain users' news feeds to control the number of posts that contained words with positively or negatively charged emotions. The team concluded that its federally funded study showed that emotions spread via contagion through a network, end quote. And departing from the article, turns out the Pentagon is very interested in that. Gee, I wonder why. Listening to Press Watch, number to call with your comments or questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. This is KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell, also from RT.com. A controversial flu researcher has modified the flu virus responsible for the 2009 pandemic to allow it to evade the human immune system. His lab's previous work includes recreating the Spanish flu and making a deadly bird flu strain highly transmittable. The yet-to-be-published research by Professor Yokoshiro Kawaoka and his team is meant to give scientists better ways to fight influenza outbreaks, but gives chills to some people in academia who are fearful that accidental release of the strain would result in a global disaster, according to a report by the Independent newspaper. At his Level 3 biosafety lab at Wisconsin University's University for Influenza Virus Research in Madison, Kawaoka experimented with the H1N1 flu strain that was responsible for the pandemic in 2009, dubbed the swine flu pandemic by the media. The work resulted in a mutated strain that is able to evade the human antibodies, effectively rendering humans defenseless against the virus. He took the 2009 pandemic flu virus, selected out strains that were not neutralized by human antibodies, repeated this several times until he got a real humdinger of a virus. That's a quote from a scientist familiar with Kawaoka's research. He's basically got a known pandemic strain that is now resistant to vaccination. Everything he did before was dangerous, but this is even madder, end quote. And I just have to agree with that assessment. I certainly remember that the Ames strain anthrax made its way out of Level 3 bioresearch facility, and it was taken out of Fort Detrick by someone, certainly not Stephen Hatfill, and the investigation was Well, let's put the investigation in air quotes and leave it at that. Inconclusive, of course, it was intended to be, but it just goes to show that a deadly thing can be taken out by a person with ill intent. And that's one way it can make it out. But there was also an anthrax scare recently in the same facility just because of an accident. So now that this exists, the world is that much less safe. And you really have to wonder where these people are coming from. The official story is that you have to create the really dangerous stuff to learn how to fight it. But that just that doesn't cut it for me. It's like you don't create the really dangerous stuff when you know there's a possibility it will get out. Now, turning to global climate change, it's 9:20 in Cascadia, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. From The Guardian in Britain, the people of Kiribati, a group of islands in the Pacific Ocean particularly exposed to climate change, now own a possible refuge elsewhere. President Anote Tong has recently finalized the purchase of 20 square kilometers on Vanua Levu, one of the Fiji islands about 2,000 kilometers away from Kiribati. The Church of England has sold a stretch of land, mainly covered by dense forest, for $8.7 million. Quote is, we would hope not to put everyone on this one piece of land, but if it became absolutely necessary, yes, we could do it. That's the end of the quote, and that's Mr. Tong telling the Associated Press, Kiribati has a population of about 110,000 scattered over 33 small low-lying islands, extending over a total area of 3.5 square kilometers. And, departing from the text here, well, they're drowning. Because climate change is happening, the oceans are rising, and their crops are being drowned. And the land is being undermined by the ocean. In 2009, the Maldives were the first to raise the possibility of purchasing lands in another country in anticipation of it being gradually submerged. At the time, the government looked at options in India and Sri Lanka. Now Kiribati has taken action. Kiribati is just the first on a list, which would get longer as time passes, says Ronald Jumo, the Seychelles ambassador at the United Nations, who took part in the international negotiations on climate change in Bonn last month. In March, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change published the volume on its adaptation of its fifth assessment report, confirming in starker terms forecasts first outlined by scientists in 1990. Within a few decades, small islands in the Pacific and Indian Oceans risk being extensively or even completely submerged. In places, the sea level is rising by 1.2 centimeters a year, four times faster than the global average. So a little storm warning there for anyone near the coast. Of course, there's much more to say about climate change. Turning again to World Socialists, WSWS.org, have an interesting article on the financial situation. You may have heard news over the last couple of days that things are better and that the Dow Jones Industrial Averages are up. Of course, the Dow Jones Industrial Averages represent the investments of very rich people for the most part. I mean, the only people who can really move it are the very rich. And they are speculating. They are getting loans in order to buy stocks, and that is driving up the price of stocks. So things are rather unstable. So I thought it would be good to pass on this article by Nick Beams. He writes, the Swiss-based Bank for International Settlements has stated that the current policies of central banks and monetary authorities could lead to another financial crisis, potentially bigger than that of 2008. The warning is contained in the latest annual report of the bank, sometimes referred to as the Central Bankers Bank, issued yesterday. The report expressed concerns that the present low interest rate regime, initiated to try to overcome the effects of the 2008 crash, has pushed financial markets to new highs while lowering the rate premium for many risky loans. The Bank for International Settlements noted that the markets have been exuberant over the past year, particularly in advanced economies. They were dancing mainly to the tune of central bank decisions, with volatility reaching historical lows and market participants hardly pricing in any risks. Overall, it is hard to avoid the sense of a puzzling disconnect between the market's buoyancy and underlying economic developments globally. This is the way they talk, buoyancy and disconnect. And it's never, gosh, people sure need to have jobs or anything like that. The disconnect, Beams writes, is most clearly expressed in the United States, where the Federal Reserve's policy of pumping trillions of dollars into financial markets has seen stock market indexes reach record highs, while the underlying economy stagnates and reverses. Last week, it was revealed that the U.S. economy contracted almost 3% in the first quarter of 2014, but stock markets climbed even further in the belief that the ongoing stagnation would lead to the provision of still more ultra-cheap money. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187, and John's on the air.
Hi, Teresa. Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a little saying that I try to live by, which is to speak to somebody who's in the trench. Just like when you're talking about that as a bus driver, that you actually witness the trains, so you actually see it with your own eyes, so you know what you're talking about. So you just mentioned the banks and the potential for financial collapse, and I recently had a job with a car rental company and was very high customer contact. Uh-huh. I would always ask everybody who I dealt with, what do you do in your day-to-day life? And there were three different individuals, one with a large bank, two with credit unions, and all of them, they are in the financial trench, and all of them agree with the analysis that another collapse will be coming, that we're living in another bubble.
Well,
and I just wanted to pass that on because, I mean, that's from the horse's mouth, as it were.
All right, I appreciate that.
You betcha.
Thanks very much for your call. Number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. And as I was saying at the beginning of the show, there's a hurricane headed for the East Coast, and see if I can find the latest news on that. Just so I can pass on the very latest, Hurricane Arthur. And also have some more news items. Of course, Hobby Lobby is in the news with Monday's decision by the Supreme Court allowing the craft store Hobby Lobby to opt out of contraceptive mandate, the contraceptive mandate of the Affordable Care Act. And this is from Ross Story in a post on his website for his new play, Allegiance. The openly gay George Takei called Monday's decision a stunning setback for women's reproductive rights. Quote, the ruling elevates the rights of a for-profit corporation over those of its women employees and opens the door to all manner of claims that a company can refuse services based on its owner's religion, end quote. He referred to Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's blistering 35-page dissent to the decision, saying, think about the ramifications. As Justice Ginsburg's stinging dissent pointed out, companies run by Scientologists could refuse to cover antidepressants, and those run by Jews or Hindus could refuse to cover medications derived from pigs, such as many anesthetics, intravenous fluids, or medications coated in gelatin. One wonders, he said, whether the case would have come out differently if a Muslim-run chain business had attempted to impose Sharia law on its employees, end quote. And here's more of a quote. Hobby Lobby is not a church. It's a business, and a big one at that. Businesses must and should be required to comply with neutrally crafted laws of general applicability. Your boss should not have a say over your health care. Once the law starts permitting exceptions based on sincerely held religious beliefs, there is no end to the mischief and discrimination that will ensue. Indeed, this is the same logic that certain restaurants and hotels have been trying to deploy to allow proprietors to refuse service to gay couples, end quote. So that's George Takei speaking to the press. You've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. This is your people's supported community radio station. Please pull up KBOO.fm and click the tip jar. Add to the effort here and stay tuned because we've got more of the incomparable radio zine coming up with Para Foggering on KBOO Portland, going out to all the ships at sea.
Podcast about KBOO. Look for the Boo Wire at KBOO.fm for the latest haps here at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue.
Tune in to KBOO for the 27th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival. KBOO will again broadcast the entire festival from noon to 10 p.m., July 3rd through the 6th. The broadcast will also be carried by various stations of Oregon Community Media for statewide coverage of this Oregon Food Bank Benefit Festival. Again, July 3rd through the 6th, noon to 10 p.m. each day here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Well, good morning. This is Per Fagrang, and the show is Fight the Empire. And my guest today is Michael Dybert, who's the author of a book, In the Shadow of Saint Death. And Michael Dybert will be speaking this next Tuesday, July 8th, at Powell's on Burnside. Starts at 7:30, but it's not a huge room, so you might want to get there early. Anyway, Michael Dybert, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, let's start out. Who is Saint Death? Who is Santa Muerte?
Santa Muerte is kind of a folk saint in Mexico.